We finished 6. We're going to be discussing 7, 8, and 9. For those just joining us, this is discussion between King Brahugana and Jad Bharata. And there's been a whole long description of Jad Bharata's previous 2 lives and beginning of this life. Transcendentalist of the topmost standard and deliberately conducting his affairs as if he's dull. Thus, Jada. Dull. Dumb. Jada. But he's not. He's deliberately not wanting to make the same mistake he made 2 lifetimes ago, where he became attached again to the covering of the soul, and he doesn't want to make that mistake again, so he's getting radical and is not just acting in Krishna consciousness while carrying out duties of life. He's not carrying out duties of life. Very different than how we're advised in Bhagavad Gita. Perform your prescribed duty and always think of Krishna. He's just always thinking of Krishna and behaving like a madman. And he's perceived by others as a madman from the previous chapters. Reference was made in the earlier part of this chapter 10 to something that happened in previous chapters. He was in such a dull condition that some worshippers of the goddess Kali concocted an idea that's not from scripture, but they thought, let's satisfy the goddess Kali by making a human sacrifice. And they thought, well, even better than an animal is a man who is like an animal. This fellow is so dull, he's like an animal. So they prepared this and that and the other thing to offer a human sacrifice to goddess Kali, and she burst out of the deity and ripped them to shreds to protect her devotee, because her devotee is Krishna's devotee, is her devotee. But even in that circumstance, Jada Bharat made no protest, and there's other earlier descriptions of how he made no protest. And in this chapter, he's making no protest, at least so far, because King Rahugana speak some sarcastic words as if flattering Jada Bharat, but he's ridiculing Jada Bharat by sarcasm. And we heard, I think it was yesterday, a king, according to the rules of kings, for those who are into being a king, there's 4 different ways that kings rule their subjects. And so one of them is chastisement. So he was chastising by sarcasm. Then coming up is he's threatening to punish him. Yeah, I've got a stick and I'm going to smack you. Didn't say exactly how he's going to use the stick, but I'm the king, I'm the ruler, you're displeasing me, I'm going to punish you. So that's another way. Appeasing by making gifts or, you know, compromise and things like that. That's another way to rule. So that's the mentality of the king. Ruled by the mode of passion. Kings are passionate, and he's thinking in terms of the body, so that's got a pretty strong ignorance element also. And Jada Bharat is beyond even the mode of goodness. He's fully transcendental. He's not just tolerating, like we're advised to go to the mode of goodness. You tolerate this and that, you know, the dualities of material life, but beyond tolerance is just, you recognize if it's cold or hot, but you're not finding happiness or distress because it's cold or hot. Now, the advice of Bhagavad Gita chapter 2 is you tolerate those things, and a transcendentalist recognizes, but they're so full with transcendental happiness and transcendental conception of self, they're literally detached, although they can perceive. So, the text prior to what we're reading this morning, there's palanquin carriers. The king wanted to go from place A to place B. They're missing one palanquin carrier, so the palanquin carrier picked up this new guy, Jad Bharat, because he was, you know, physically looked fit and mentally looked dull enough that he could, you know, be the palanquin carrier. And the problem was he wasn't dull. He was a transcendentalist that didn't want to harm ants, and ants would pass on the road, so he'd stop till they crossed the road, and then he would continue, and that was jostling the king. So he made his sarcastic remarks. First he said to the palanquin carriage, "You better watch out." And they protested, saying, "It's not us, it's that guy. He's a new guy. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't carry properly." So then the words of sarcasm came from the king. Jad Bharat didn't become disturbed by hearing, like we sometimes get disturbed when we hear people say, "Nah, rah, rah. You're a something or other." And then mind gets disturbed. But his mind wasn't disturbed. So, part two, he continued carrying and more watching out for the ants on the road. And then the king used another methodology of controlling the subjects. Text 7. Thereafter, when the king saw that his palanquin was still being shaken by the carriers, he became very angry and said, "You rascal!" He's speaking to a topmost devotee. He's in trouble. "You rascal, what are you doing? Are you dead despite the life within your body? Do you not know that I am your master? You are disregarding me and are not carrying out my order. For this disobedience, I shall now punish you. Just as Yamaraj, the superintendent of death, punishes sinful people, I shall give you proper treatment so that you will come to your senses and do the correct thing." No purport. Text 8. Thinking himself a king, King Rahugana was in the bodily conception and was influenced by material nature's modes of passion and ignorance. Due to madness, he chastised Jada Bharat with uncalled for and contradictory words. Jada Bharat was a topmost devotee and the dear abode of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although considering himself very learned, the king did not know about the position of an advanced devotee situated in devotional service, nor did he know his characteristics. Jada Bharat was the residence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He always carried the form of the Lord within his heart. He was the dear friend of all living beings, and he did not entertain any bodily conception. He therefore smiled and spoke the following words. And they're quite complimentary. He's not reacting. So, purport. The distinction between a person in the bodily conception and a person beyond the bodily conception is presented in this verse. In the bodily conception, King Rahugana considered himself a king and chastised Jada Bharata in so many unwanted ways. Being self-realized, Jada Bharata, who was fully situated in the transcendental platform, did not at all become angry. Instead, he smiled and began to deliver his teachings to King Rahugana. A highly advanced Vaishnava devotee is a friend to all living entities, and consequently, he is a friend to his enemies also. In fact, he does not consider anyone to be his enemy. Suradak sarvadehinam. Where's that from? It's from Rishabhdev's teaching, Kapiladev's teachings, the qualities, one of the qualities of a devotee. Suradak sarvadehinam. Sometimes a Vaishnava becomes superficially angry at a non-devotee, but this is good for the non-devotee. We have several examples of this in Vedic literature. Once, Narada became angry. He wasn't exactly angry. He was benedicting them, but became angry with the two sons of Kuvera, Nalakuvera and Manigriva, and he chastised them by turning them into trees. The result was that later they were liberated by Lord Sri Krishna. The devotee is situated on the absolute platform, and when he is angry or pleased, there is no difference, for in either case he bestows his benediction. And text number 9. Well, just on that one, it's one of my favorite sections of Srimad Bhagavatam, because Shukadeva Goswami takes us inside the contemplations of Narada. Very confidential. Like, what does Narada think when, I mean, besides it was disgusting, it was an offense. He's a sadhu, and not only they didn't receive the sadhu, but they were shamelessly misbehaving before the sadhu. So it was implicitly an offense. But Narada didn't take offense. What did he do? He considered, why is this and what's best for these two? And he considered this and considered it. Contemplation was compassion. And contemplation wasn't reacting. And contemplation was compassion. And his consideration was, these men, they're intoxicated with pride. They're intoxicated with intoxication. But more significantly, they're intoxicated with pride. And the reason they're intoxicated with pride is because of their opulence. They're sons of Kuvera, and Kuvera's rich, and so they think we're special because we're rich, as the sons of Kuvera is rich. We're rich. We're wealthy. And their father had very special relationship with Lord Shiva, so we're very special because Lord Shiva resides in our father's kingdom, Mount Kailash, as part of Kuvera's pleasure garden. And because Kuvera was such an ardent devotee of Lord Shiva, and he invited Lord Shiva, please come reside in my forest garden, Lord Shiva obliged. So we're dear to Lord Shiva and we're wealthy, so look out. And whenever when someone is proud, Narada explains, like several verses, that one can do harmful things to others and not think anything about it, because you're up there and they're down there and you're proud and they're dispensable. Their well-being is not something I consider my well-being because I'm big and they're small. Pride. So one is proud, one can do very hurtful things to others, and he specifically speaks about animal killing. Prabhupada speaks about it. Interesting. You know, where in religions, you name them, and they speak of nonviolence or being kind to others or being protectors of others, but it extends only to their family or their community or their religious group or maybe even broader, and you know, others with the same form of life, the human form of life, our group, humans, and others are dispensable and compassion doesn't extend to them. And doing harm to them is not a problem. And then you just fill in the blank, because fill in the blank. Animals have no soul, or animals are meant for man. Where does it say that animals have no soul? Or that animals are, anyway, without going into it. But even persons who are religious have their justification. It's okay. Anyway, pride is the influencer, according to Narada's contemplation. And then once pride is there, then your whole conception of life gets colored. And you don't see others are suffering. And I don't have to subsist by others suffering or minimize the suffering of others. I could do that. But no, because, and then the rationale. So that's coming from pride. So how to relieve these two from their pride? Really easy. Just take away their opulence. These things are going on in the world without elaborating, you know, things are going on in the world. Prabhupada would often speak about the British Empire and, you know, the atrocities of the British Empire. So they got reduced. Their opulences got reduced dramatically and so forth and so on. It's how Kali Yuga proceeds. Passion and fruitive activities and the standard of happiness, of the standard of a good leader of government, whatever his title is gross national product grows. And you know, to do that, go ahead. We'll look the other way how you do it, and you just do it. And sinful activities, and then there's consequences because of that pride. Now we're strong and we can step on people. Anyway, there's consequences for that. So the opulences were taken away from the two brothers. And since Narada considered they want to stand naked, okay, they can stand naked as a tree for thousands of years. But the tree will be in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj, and Krishna will deliver them after they've become freed from pride. And then they can become bhaktas instead of proudful sons of Kuvira. So it wasn't really anger, it was benedictory. He didn't say it in a mood of anger, he said it in a mood of, this is going to be good for you too. So same that we're going to hear the next verse is Jad Bharata giving some, to begin, the whole rest of the chapter is his teachings. And then after the teachings comes the next chapter where Rahugana says, wow, you're not a dull person, you're a perfected soul. How did this happen? And can you give me some more teachings? And he asks some specific questions. So this is the teachings section of Jadabharat. And it starts in an appropriate place, just like Bhagavad Gita starts with you're not the body, you know, Sankhya. Then once you thoroughly understand that, then what do you do? How do you carry out the activities of life? Supposing you're a king, or supposing you're whoever you are, how do you carry out the activities of life knowing we're not this body? I know you can be like Jad Bharat and just be radical, or you could be, as Krishna is indicating to Arjuna, you can carry out your prescribed duty, but and think of Krishna, what does that look like? And we're going to hear. It's very nice, very practical, and quite transcendental. So, text 9, the great Brahmana Jadabharata said, my dear king and hero, whatever you have spoken sarcastically is certainly true. Actually, these are not simply words of chastisement, for the body is the carrier. The load carried by the body does not belong to me, for I am the spirit soul. There is no contradiction in your statements, because I am different from the body. I am not the carrier of the palanquin, the body is the carrier. Certainly, as you have hinted, I have not labored carrying the palanquin, for I am detached from the body. You have said that I am not stout and strong, and these words are befitting a person who does not know the distinction between the body and the soul. The body may be fat or thin, but no learned man would say such things of the spirit soul. As far as the spirit soul is concerned, I am neither fat nor skinny. Therefore, you're correct when you say that I'm not very stout. Also, if the object of this journey and the path leading there were mine, there would be many troubles for me. But because they relate not to me but to my body, there's no trouble at all. Short purport. In Bhagavad Gita is stated that one who is advanced in spiritual knowledge is not disturbed by the pains and pleasures of the material body. It doesn't say you don't detect them, but not disturbed by them. The material body is completely separate from the spirit soul, and the pains and pleasures of the body are superfluous. Next sentence is nice. The practice of austerity and penance is meant for understanding the distinction between the body and the soul, and how the soul can be unaffected by the pleasures and pains of the body. Jadabharata was actually situated on the platform of self-realization. He was completely aloof from the bodily conception. Therefore, he immediately took this position, and convinced the king that whatever contradictory things the king had said about his body did not apply to him as a spirit soul. Well, spiritual understanding comes in this descending manner. Remember hearing a lecture Prabhupada explained, even the most elementary of understandings about the existence of the soul, other than the exceptional circumstance of Shukadeva Goswami, for example, who even knows about this soul from the time of birth? Nobody. And even to have the concept that there is such a thing as a soul, you have to hear it. And then whether you accept it or not is another thing, but even just like to begin, it's descending mercy, hearing from an authority is required. And then, how do you understand it? Well, you know, there's the concept, and whether the concept is something that you entertain or not entertain depends a lot on conditioning and the modes of nature. Elevated scientists and philosophers reject the idea, you know, heatedly and ardently, just can't consider it. Some are neutral, some take it as reasonable, but very few act on that platform, or at least cultivate living on that platform, moving forward in life on that platform. It's rare, even amongst devotees. We can, you know, all agree we're not this body, but do we live our lives that way? And how do you live your life that way? Well, one of the indications given in the purport is austerities and penances are meant to help us realize in a practical way we're not this body. And when we hear about this, what are penances and austerities for a devotee? Because penances and austerities are meant, you know, ultimately for realization of our true identity, but also curbing material tendency. And as material tendency is in a reasonable, not a fanatical or extremist kind of way, just in little ways, just like tomorrow is a disappearance day of Bhaktisiddhanta, so we have a half-day fast. Not a big deal, half-day fast. But it's helpful in one sense, because it's an auspicious day to observe and hear something about Bhaktisiddhanta, so on the occasion of his disappearance to hear something about him, it's auspicious. So it's diminishing on this side and increasing on that side. And that helps give one strength or spiritual determination. I very clearly remember, I've said it so many times, that hearing just the recordings of a lecture series in Los Angeles, Topmost Yoga, chapter, that recording of Prabhupada, the devotees reading chapter 6, verse and purport, and Prabhupada would interrupt and then explain, and then they carry on after he finished giving his commentary. So they covered the whole chapter, Topmost Yoga. And they published a book, Topmost Yoga, based on that exchange. So in chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita, the word dhira is there. D-H-I-R-A, dhira. And dhira's tatra namuyati. Dhira means, Prabhupada has translated as sober. You know, sober as opposed to, I guess, intoxicated, inebriated. You know, you've lost your faculties. So dhira means one remains undisturbed. Even there's cause for disturbance, Prabhupada explained. It's not something wonderful if you remain undisturbed when there's no cause for disturbance. But it's something wonderful if there's cause for disturbance and one remains undisturbed. That is dhira. And then how does one become dhira? How does one get that status or that control? Well, it takes some, he explains, takes some determination. How do you strengthen determination? By undergoing austerities and penances. You know, not the extreme kind, a radical kind, or self-created, self-flagellation kind. Just, you know, standard ones that are for Vaishnavas. Then he mentions fasting on appearance days of the Lord or his devotees, on Ekadasis, and we increase hearing and chanting. So religiously, or dutifully, or as scriptures enjoin, we take those up. Not just the mechanical part of, you know, fasting because you're supposed to fast, but in a devotional sense, I want to increase on this auspicious day my meditation on the form of the Lord that appeared, and so forth. Like, you know, Moksha Ekadasi. It can be just an opportunity to sponsor, have people sponsor Bhagavad Gita so we can get a book score with the BBT. That's nice. Get a book score with the BBT. Service. But the deeper meditation is to honor Krishna and the previous acharyas, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his representatives, wish for the Sankirtan, congregational chanting of the Lord and his glories and his teachings, be heard widely, so pleasing them. And so he makes some sacrifice for pleasing them. That's the bhakti principle being exercised. Because we're weak. We need to do a little spiritual therapy. Like with physical therapy, the body's weak, so you exercise something. So, in principle, the purpose of these austerities and penances is to strengthen our devotion, because it's only through knowledge and realization of that knowledge can be enhanced by controlling the mind and senses in some kind of detachment from the pleasures of the mind and senses. But that's preliminary. More profound is awakening of devotion for the personality of Godhead and using the mind and the body for that purpose, pleasing Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam for their pleasure. Priti Purvakam. Engaging in those activities with a desire, at least a hankering, to come to the stage of transcendence, loving the personality of Godhead, not loving the body and the comforts of the body, but loving the personality of Godhead. So that strengthens knowledge and strengthens, if depending upon where you're coming from when you do those things, it's strengthening devotion. So much depends upon where your attention goes, or the purpose behind the activities of devotion. So we're hearing, as Prabhupada explains in the purport, we're hearing that this compare and contrast. Over here, the king is he's pious. He knows the Vedas. He knows the principles of ruling. But he's also ruled by passion and ignorance. So he's thinking he's the master. We're going to hear, you know, you're a fool, you're not the master. And one who thinks you're the master, you're a fool. Shows your ignorance. There is a master. There's a master of all of us. Little flashback on Dwarka. The whole area of Dwarka, from the Vedic point of view, is known by the name of the son of a king whose name was Anartha, which is spelled differently than, you know, the impurities of heart, Anartha. It's an A-N-A-R-T-A. So the king, his father, had four sons, and he you know, I'm virtuous and righteous, and I'm handing over my kingdom to all of you. and by my strength, and you always be like bragging. And now I'm turning it over to you. And so one son said, well, you know, you're Maya. You didn't do this, and you know, you're dependent. We're all dependent upon the Supreme Lord. He's the proprietor, not you. And the strength to rule comes from him, not you. And, you know, thanks for the kingdom, but, you know, your whole premise is wrong. And the king became very upset. Said, then I take back the kingdom from you, and you can go reside somewhere other than my kingdom. And he was ruling of the world. So, what to do? Obey your father, like Lord Ramachandra. So he went into the sea and began performing austerities for a long, long time to please Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu came, this is from Skanda Purana, and Lord Vishnu came, you please me very much, what is it you would like? Well, I'd like a kingdom that's like a place to live in some service. Since I'm a Kshatriya, then you're ruling something, but it has to be where it's not my father's kingdom, because that's what my father said. So the kingdom was created in the sea, Dwaraka. So he ruled there, and he became very righteous and virtuous and powerful king, and his father went, wow, that was pretty good. His father honored his son with his strength and virtue and power. And, you know, he helped his father get out of Maya. So how to deal with a situation when there's insult or injury or both? Well, it depends on our consciousness. It also depends on our capacity. It also depends on the circumstance. But the benedictory decision made by Jad Bharat was he spoke transcendental knowledge. Now, previously, when others were offending him and speaking harshly to him, he said nothing. In this case, he's saying something. It's not specifically stated, but intuitively, he understood Rahugana can receive transcendental knowledge, and the others can't, so I'm not going to bother. But he is so virtuous, then I can speak. So he did. And the king got it. So that's something that as devotees, that the application, one of the application points for us is as devotees, we have to be considerate of the circumstance, the person, time, place, circumstance. What should we do? What's appropriate? Jad Bharat demonstrated that. Narada was really good at demonstrating that. Prabhupada was excellent at demonstrating that. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was perfect at demonstrating that. Sometimes and sometimes. But always for the well-being, the with compassion and concern for others. That's the place that devotees should act from. And so in this case, we're going to be hearing tomorrow also, a whole series of, whenever you resume classes again, a whole series of wonderful instructions about not only, you know, Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, you're not the body, but how to live your life with that understanding. Knowledge and detachment. And in that mood of detachment, clarity. Because when there's attachment, clarity gets lost at best. When commonly does the wrong thing instead of the right thing, but to speak of clarity gets lost. The stronger one's attachment is. Detachment doesn't mean I don't care. Detachment means the conception of life that you have allows for careful contemplation, what is appropriate, that kind of detachment. Because the attachment, you have to be attached to something. Attachment is to serving Krishna. And in that position of attachment, what's the best way to serve Krishna? That kind of detachment. Not I don't care. And we care about service to Krishna. Different circumstances come into our life. There's different opportunities for serving Krishna. Some are fun and some are difficult and some are confusing and some are this and some are that. It's just different opportunities for service. And we try to stay in the mood of service and seek clarity how to best serve Krishna in the different circumstances of life. So here, he's giving transcendental knowledge to the king. And he's speaking very complimentary. He's flattering the king at the same time. He's chastising him. You fool. Oh, great king. What you said is right. Congratulations. Okay, so we'll end there, see if there's any comments or discussion. Yes. You got your hand up before she did. Congratulations. Go ahead. Prabhupada, I'm just repeating Prabhupada, yeah.
But it seems to me that for performing specific austerities, you need determination.
You need determination? You need a willingness. You need some submission. The austerity itself will test your determination, but there has to be some submission even to begin. That's where it begins. So then best to take some austerity that's realistic for my capacity, so that not only I can fulfill it, but I can remain mindful of the purpose behind it as I'm undergoing that. And it strengthens. Let's I like the comparison of physical therapy. You know, so somebody has an accident or something and they lose the use of some part of their body. Their arm can't move, just like even to lift their arm. Can't lift my arm. So then they take the problem to a physical therapist and they see, you know, what's going on, and can you do, you know, 10 of these a day? So your statement is there has to be some capacity and some willingness, some confidence in the therapist. They know what they're doing. They know what the problem is. They know how to get me out of the problem. There's some faith, some confidence, and a willingness to submit to, you know, do 10 of these 3 times a day. You've said two different things. One is keep the standard and the other is all the time.
So,
how to go forward to your capacity. Here's a real simple one. Chant 16 rounds. Well, I'm just a beginner. I don't know if I can chant 16 rounds. Okay, what can you chant every day? chant one. Okay, great. Chant one. Every day. Well, I don't know if you can chant it every day. Well, make your best effort to chant one round every day. Get your capacity. Try to be determined. Make that commitment one round every day. Not so difficult. Yeah, it's not so difficult. But I get distracted sometimes. You got a lot of homework, or, you know, there's a deadline at work, or something, you know, some relative is sick, and I got to take care, you know, I have to do stuff. Okay. Try to do it anyways. Then, gradually. It's according to one's capacity. With faith, acting with commitment, capacity increases. Krishna is pleased and you get strength and capacity increases.
So,
that's what we should do.
So sometimes our body doesn't cooperate with one
another. So I've noticed. Yes. Now, some people have more determination than others. Some people have more capacity to overcome bodily pain and bodily limitations than others. Sometimes. So sometimes, according to the circumstance, to your capacity, maintain the commitment as far as possible. And by that determination will increase. Capacity will increase. Sometimes you have to recalibrate. I don't have that capacity. Or because of illness or because of something or something, then I go to plan B until that illness is over, and then I go to plan A. According to capacity. Yes.
Disciple relationship, which you spoke on Bharatiyata, where a disciple shouldn't delay the instruction if so there is a reaction to it.
A disciple should do what?
Shouldn't delay the instruction of spirit.
Shouldn't delay. Well, qualified. Prabhupada accepted the instruction of Bhaktisiddhanta in his heart. And he felt, I need to qualify myself. So he didn't discard the instruction. He delayed acting on the instruction, and he lamented later, oh, I wasted so much time. But he didn't let go of the instruction. So you can prepare yourself, that's okay.
So the next question.
I'm listening.
Was participating in the question and answer sections in the Bhagavatam and so forth. Questions may pertain coming from just an inquisitive nature.
Yeah.
Some questions come to really apply on the
some are just frivolous.
So, keeping everything in the box, so does those questions still have its own reaction if someone just asks?
Oh. You're looking for light. You have something?
I just want to share a little bit quickly and as a question. So this topic about nonviolence.
Mm.
2 days ago, you presented on it today.
Mm.
So the day you presented it that evening, my boss came down and wanted to have a discussion again. He tells us everything. And back and forth, we touched on this core. Why kill the animals? And, you know, forget sin or sin. You have this idea of compassion. Why kill the animals? So he referenced Genesis. In fact, I read that section of Genesis. Where God
gives dominion.
You have the ability to use resources judiciously, where you have the capabilities of envy. Because there isn't, my question was very pointed. Where does it say there's a difference between animals and humans? So you pointed to that humans are made in the image of God, and all all these other creatures are there to support that so that humans can glorify God. So again, I went to the point question, you can bash him on them, why do you have to kill them when you have a choice? He couldn't answer. At that point he said, let me set up a meeting with my pastors at church and ask those questions. But this is a very thoughtful person, and he wasn't able to move from there. He wasn't able to give a good response to that question.
Well, to prepare yourself for that discussion with his priest, because he'll have his tools honed to justify, because otherwise he's a hypocrite, so he'll have his tools. I would suggest that you have a dialogue with somebody that's already, you know, from the Vaishnava side, looked at this. There's three people that I can think of. One is Satyaraj, another is Rabindra Swarup Prabhu, and a third is Sri Nandanandana, because they've, you know, gotten into it. And, you know, one obvious one is dominion. Now, I don't know what the present version of Genesis says about dominion, but there's a dictionary definition, and dominion doesn't mean exploit. Dominion means you protect. Man, in the superior position, has dominion. Not to take advantage of, but to give protection to, like a king. Doesn't exploit. He has dominion. In fact, that's one of the terms of, you know, countries, is that the dominion of, and you know, it doesn't mean you exploit the citizens because you're the prime minister or the whatever it is of the dominion. You have dominion, so you get protection. You know, research it. And that would be my advice, because he's going to have his, you know, like Cardinal Daniel, you, his stuff. He didn't answer the question, the cardinal. Where does it say? He didn't say where it says, because it doesn't say animals have no soul. So be prepared. You know, is there a soul, you know, pointedly, is there a soul within the animal or not? Or, you know, take one step back. What does it mean to have, that there's a soul? Because that's interesting. You know, for some, you don't have a soul until you accept Jesus Christ. Really? So what does that mean? Before you accept Jesus Christ, you don't have a soul, then you're in the same category as an animal. You've potential food for the, no, you don't do that. Why not? Be consistent. Is there a soul? What does it mean? There's a presence of a soul. And where there's presence of a soul, is there consciousness? And if there's consciousness out there, is there not feelings? And if you're causing pain and suffering to others, is it not a better way to live to not get pain and suffering? Well, you get pain and suffering to plants. So is the pain, okay, true. Although, anyway, then you go through the whole thing. What does it mean that there's a soul within the tree? You take the apple, have you killed the tree? What's the pain? Or wheat? It's already dead. Can you subsist without causing pain or not? Is that a better way to live or not? According to the teachings. Oh, you have dominion over stuff. Which is the better way to live? Let's go to Christ, stand at his, bow at his feet and ask him, is it better to live a life where you don't give pain to others than you don't mind giving pain to others because you have dominion over them? That's pride. I have the right to do it because I'm up there and, you know, there are resources for supporting me. Just, you know, logic. And, you know, guided by values. Religious values. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but probably not. But, you know, at least, you know, the conclusion is, well, you're thoughtful about your convictions. We just don't agree with them. You're not a blind follower of your convictions. You have very thoughtfulness behind your convictions. But you know, from our position, we say the scripture doesn't, God isn't two, isn't two. God is one. And his message is the same for everybody. The language used is different. The message is not different. So you can interpret this way or that way. What's the spirit of the message? Who knows what the Aramaic was from Genesis? And now it's rendered this way. And your school of Christianity reads this way, and you know, you go to different schools and they read it a whole other way. So let's just speak principle. Common sense. That's what Prabhupada would say. Let's speak common sense. You're a father, you have children. Are you going to entertain? So that let's go bigger and bigger and bigger. God is the Supreme Father, and all living entities are his sons, not just one. All living entities, he's the Father, all living entities. How does he view all living entities? How does he want them to, how do you want your children to behave with each other? Respectful. You can have your individuality and your differences and your likes and your dislikes, and that's fine. Be respectful. Don't be exploitive. Culture is gone. In Vedic culture, the elder brother is treated like the father. But say the elder brother is going to, what's he going to do? This brother over there, he's dull. Meal. Is that culture? Is that God's way? Probably nothing will change. And you know, it's, that's from the get-go. The interest of having such a dialogue with you, my boss, and the minister of your church, is not to get you to give up that ism and take this ism. That's not where, you know, it's, let's try to understand God's message. That's for us. How does he want us to live our life? That's all. Are there, the answer is yes. Are there writings in the early days of the Christian church that speak that Christ was vegetarian? And how did it become otherwise?
We asked him that question about, is there evidence of Christ consistently eating non-vegetarian food? And he said yes, and he quoted a few examples
of that. Satyaraj. And the veracity of those particular examples, how do we know? That the historians that were present during his time or just two generations after his time, they knew more details than, you know, the modern translations and renderings of the New Testament have. They were present. You know, I'm not a professor, I'm not a scholar, but this much is very clear. It's, you know, there's the consistency in this message. Now there's differences of views, but there's consistency in this message. So let us just consider a principle. Whether, you know, those scholars or contemporaries of Christ, and then the current version of the New Testament that you're making references from, there may be some contradictions. So how do we sort it out. Let's use some common sense. The nature of Christ is compassion. Everybody knows that. And how does compassion flow? It flows down and lifts people up, or lifts others. So with that principle, aside from this authority, that authority, common sense. If I can live my life that does not cause the sacrifice of the life of others for me, doesn't that the sign of compassion? Think about it. Yeah. Yeah.
So, in our lives, we have Krishna presents very colorful situations of eventually assisting people. And unlike Jarabhara, who's awfully transcendental and has strong intuition and is very successful with King Hogan, we make mistakes along the way. Experience, lack of connection with super soul, etc. Sufficient value. So how should we, sincerely trying to improve ourselves, how do we regard those mistakes in trying and in seeing that those result in the philosophy?
Regret and move on. Honestly acknowledge this is tapa. For a Vaishnava, we recognize, we take responsibility particularly between us and Krishna and whoever else, and we trust in Krishna and we move on. With the wish, or stronger, the determination that we don't do this again, knowing that determination is not so strong, and we may do it again. We may replicate the same mistake, because that's generally how things happen. History repeats itself. Our shortcomings repeat themselves. But we trust in Krishna that he'll help us. It's something like the example of nectar devotion of a child that has the ability to walk. So walking capacity is within. That's why children can eventually, from toddling, start to walk, and then they're running, and they're all over the place. So just by continuing to make efforts to walk, the walking ability comes out. Similarly, it's natural. The quality of pure devotion is natural for us, for the soul. We're covered by so much conditioning, but it's a natural position, so we just carry on. With regret of the past contamination, and therefore I'm carrying stuff, let me honestly recognize the stuff and the misfortune that it brings to me and in my interactions with others, and I wish to overcome it. I make a commitment to Krishna with the determination that's at my command, knowing that I'll again likely make some sense, not like use that as an excuse. I guess it's okay because people continue to make the same mistakes, so it's authorized. We just, it's going to happen, but we continue with the determination to overcome and depend on Krishna. If you wait until you're perfect before you try to extend yourselves to others, you got a long way. It's part of purification. Okay, I'm going to end. It's 9:00. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.